Hi, this is Dave Weigel. I'm a reporter for the Washington Independent.
And I'm Tim Fernholz. I am a writing fellow at the American Prospect magazine.
It's really good to see you. I'm glad you're still alive. I think you're still alive. I hear the voice of somebody claiming to be Tim Fernholz, which is more human contact than I've gotten from a lot of people this weekend in D.C.
I've survived Snow MG.
Snow MG. Didn't one of our local newspapers actually use that as a headline?
If they didn't, I would be very disappointed in them.
I think the Washington Post free paper, which is written for the kids, for the cool kids, did that. I mean, I preferred... So everyone in D.C. is on Twitter and basically uses it as a playground to outwit each other. But everyone seemed to agree pretty early on that this blizzard we're all suffering under was going to be called the Snowpocalypse. And I'm okay with that.
There was thunder snow briefly. There was a time when people thought maybe there would be thunder as well, but that apparently didn't happen. Very disappointing.
The snow of Thor, as my friend Mandy Simon put it. By Thor's hammer, the snow will fall. Yeah, it was bad, but... You know, I don't know where you're from. I'm from Delaware, which has the same... Wait, where are you from?
I'm from New Hampshire, so this is really nothing special.
Okay, so you're on my side about this, that most civilized parts of this country that have regular snowfalls are able to handle them much better than D.C. is.
Yes.
I mean, we've survived... I don't know what blizzards you've had, but Delaware had these mid-Atlantic blizzards in 1994 and 6 and... whatever else, and I lived in Chicago when I went to college, and we had, you know, regular, not just dumps of snow, but snow that would sit on the ground and then freeze because it would fall down to 0 degrees outside, and everyone just kind of dealt with it. And in this city, I'm working from home today because my office building in DuPont Circle is closed, and, you know, DuPont Circle is, it's on the Connecticut Avenue is a snow escape route out of the city, one of the few that was cleared by one of the 6 snowplows that we have to use this. But you know, otherwise, I'm not able to access anything in this city. I mean, is there a reason for that? Because I've gotten better in touch with my libertarian roots than I have in any time this year.
You know, it seems to me you should be getting in touch with your non-libertarian roots if you're complaining about D.C.'s failure to deal with the snow problem. I guess what the newspapers are saying is that this is the most snow I've ever seen in D.C., and apparently more snow fell in the 24-hour period over this weekend than falls in an entire year normally. And apparently Fenty is considered, the mayor of D.C., Adrian Fenty, is considered to have done a good job compared to, I guess, Marion Barry, which is a pretty low bar for public services.
Well, he didn't try to snort any of it. I mean,
not that anyone saw.
Bonus, yeah.
Nobody set him up. But... I don't know. I mean, it's even President Obama criticized D.C. Earlier in his term for shutting down during the snowstorm. But I will say the federal government closed today, which is ridiculous. But the D.C. government was open, so for what it's worth, at least they're trying to tough it out.
Well, that's heartening. I mean, but it, I guess generally, with the stuff that shut down was transportation. Roads that couldn't be shuffled, but as with happens a lot in D.C., the buck was passed from people who knew better, from the city government to Congress, for just, you know, controlling a lot of these purse strings and operations and not letting the city run this well. And I mean, I don't quite buy that. I think it's more that it's a southern city that has northern weather patterns. They don't know how to hack it. But it does seem like many of D.C.'s problems go back to its relationship with Congress, which, you know, Congress tightened the grip in 1995 when Marion Barry was reelected and Republicans took over Congress because the city wasn't very governable. And since then, it's become very governable and gentrified, but we're still living under these ridiculous rules where members of Congress from, you know, well, every part of the country that's not D.C. are able to govern, you know, how much we spend on snow removal, whether or not we vote, whether or not we have...
A great example is just the other week, for the first time, the Congress repealed a ban on D.C. using local funding for abortions. Like, you know, the federal government was saying what D.C. tax money could be used for while not allowing D.C. residents to vote on what their federal tax money is used for. So
well, the same thing happened with marijuana, right? I mean, there was a Congress imposed. Yeah. Congress had, well, the city voted to... legalize or decriminalize marijuana, and Congress overruled it. And again, this is when the Republicans were bringing the hammer down everything. Yeah, I mean, I enjoy blaming Congress for everything more than every American, every other American can. I guess this also, Congress's power plays over D.C. also presage, I think, some of the Democratic problems that happened throughout the year. Because one of the first agenda items, because it looked like it was going to be an easy one, was passing a compromise that would give D.C. residents the right to vote for a member of Congress. I mean, yeah. We can vote for one, but you can't do anything.
Eleanor Holmes Norton is great, but she doesn't have a vote. And the compromise was the Democrats were going to go and give Utah an additional seat in Congress to even things out. It was a pretty straightforward exchange.
And the Utahns were for it. It was hammered out by Tom Davis, who was a Republican from Virginia, who got replaced by a Democrat. But and then I think what happened with it was that Blue Dog Democrats and Republicans collaborated to it, make it combine this with another law that would repeal all of D.C.'s gun regulations, of which there are many.
A nice poison pill.
And so Democrats ended up just caving and letting this die, and, you know, I don't think anyone foresees more than 60 Democrats in the Senate anytime soon. So this was really early in 2009. It was the first example of them having power.
Things to come.
Getting rolled by Republicans.
It's just so ridiculous that, you know, Republicans in Congress and these blue dogs, you know, who are normally proponents of a very sort of assertive federalism where localities get to have their say, think that every, you know, group of constituents in the United States should be able to run things from the ground up except people who live in the District of Columbia. I mean,
well, one thing we have to get used to in D.C. is that not only does the rest of the country not have a lot of esteem for us, but it's, you know, if you're running for office and your people you have to pay attention to and appeal to are, you know, conservative voters, they obviously hate this city. I mean, they wish we had more snow. They wish that, you know, Democratic senators had actually been buried, you know, day after tomorrow style, unable to be rescued by Jake Gyllenhaal in time to make the Senate votes on health care. Well, you know, so it's really no, there's no downside if you're a Republican, or, you know, one of these blue dogs from Alabama, and you want to just put the screws in D.C. and make our lives as miserable as possible.
Well, that's exactly what happened this weekend during the great health care cloture vote. Senator Tom Coburn was offering prayers that the snow would prevent people from getting back to D.C. to vote on the bill so the Democrats wouldn't be able to stop their filibuster. And just sort of a ridiculous picture of where the Republicans are right now, that their chief legislative tactic is not just filibustering bills, but praying that the Lord will send snow to prevent senators, you know, from making it. It's totally ridiculous. And the Democrats, of course, freaked out about it and went after them with various statements. But, you know, the politics around healthcare, you know, are just finding new levels of being ridiculous. And it's funny to watch Republicans, you know, last week they filibustered the defense bill in order to, you know, it was a bank shot filibuster to try and stop the healthcare bill from coming up from consideration. I mean, it's just one thing after another to prevent the supposedly extremely unpopular healthcare bill from even having an up or down vote.
Right. Well, I noticed a shift. The one thing I'd point out, and then you just ask that, is I noticed a shift really in the last week or 2 weeks of Republicans going from explaining that they were disappointed that this process was so lousy and they weren't able to get a better bill to outright opposition. I mean, Michael Steele had an event last week at the RNC headquarters about how the RNC was on America's side against this bill. So, yeah, they've gone to flat-out opposition instead of even pretending that they want to play fair and let people vote on the thing. But what were you going to ask?
Oh, no, I was going to ask, you know, what do you see in the dynamics here? I mean, the politics that we're talking about here, exactly starting with that gun bill, starting with the stimulus last spring and going forward, has just been straight-up obstructionism and their efforts to pretend at sort of playing we're not being reached out to, or no one is coddling us enough, or no one is listening to our ideas have certainly faded away, but the underlying structure of just saying no to everything hasn't. And Republicans are betting that that's going to be a political winner for them because apparently the system is going to reward a minority that prevents any kind of responsible governing from happening. Is that really a winner, you think, coming up for 2010, the new election cycle that everyone's getting so excited to start talking about a year in advance?
I don't think anything that they do in the Senate is as important as the economy. I think elections are deterministic like that. And I think any Republican strategist you talk to will tell you this, you know, if better than expectations, there's an obvious recovery that starts in April, and, you know, we're down to, you know, unemployment it falls back to what it was when Obama was inaugurated, even by the election, then Democrats are going to win whatever they do. This strategy, though, I do think they looked at how Democrats came out of the gate in 2005 and blocked Bush's agenda and then took back the Congress. But one, Bush's agenda in 2005 had, like, nothing to do with what he ran on, nothing to do with what voters cared about. I mean, he pushed for 6 months on Social Security privatization and barely had mentioned that in the campaign. You know, the Democrats on health care are enacting something that they've been promising for the last 60 years. I mean, however many election cycles that is, several presidents ago. So, one, it was expected, and, you know, two, I think John Chait made a good argument about this over the weekend or maybe late last week in the New Republic when he suggested that by being completely obstinate and just being on betting that Americans get tired of the Democrats and reject all this, Republicans have ceded the ability to influence this bill at all, to ever take advantage if some element of it becomes popular. And I think that that's basically true, just because Republicans I was talking to today don't think they'll, if they win the election in 2010 even, they're going to be able to roll this back. I mean, they're going to end up having one Senate seats, but as much as they did in 1966, in 1980, they're not actually going to be able to roll back the welfare state. They're just going to cut more taxes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly what they're going to try to do, but I will say this, I don't think that they can take back either chamber. I think it would be a pretty wild year, much wilder than I think anybody anticipates if they come close to that. I mean, and the Democrats have a pretty good margin to work with, and I think also you're right about the economy part of this. If unemployment is trending in the right direction, that's really going to be the defining factor. But on healthcare in particular, you know, people like Megan McArdle, Republicans, are all saying that, you know, passing healthcare is going to be some kind of killer on the political front for the Democrats. But there's a couple of reasons that just isn't right. One is, you know, you talk about rolling back the welfare state, but the welfare state aspects of this bill don't really kick in until about 2013. That's when you have the individual mandate that requires you to buy insurance. That's when you have the subsidies that makes that mandate palatable. You know, that's when all of the sort of fiscal parts of this bill go into effect. But what you have immediately is all of these regulations on the insurance companies that people are going to like. You know, the rescission regulations that, you know, insurance companies can't drop you from your coverage. They can't deny you from coverage for a pre-existing condition. And I think one that's really underestimated is one that's going to say children can stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 27. So you're going to see, you know, a big chunk of people graduating from college this spring who would have had to get their own health insurance in a job market where it's going to be hard for them to get a job, and, you know, where individual insurance is expensive, and they'll be able to stay on their parents' plan. People are going to like that. I think if Democrats start to campaign on this and be positive about it, it's going to be a net benefit for them.
I actually used the COBRA boost that was part of the stimulus. I actually took advantage of that back in the beginning of 2009, and that made me feel better about my government. That was the first real handout I'd had in a while, and
you earned it.
I should have felt dirty.
That's right. Does it work, my friend?
It's my money. I paid for it. It's mine. It's like the Panama Canal. I think
the number of nuclear missiles.
Actually, yeah, it's my National Guard I paid for, too. Why don't they clean these streets up? no, I think the Republican argument against health care reform isn't actually going to be... I was on a conference call today with Michael Steele and with Dick Armey, which I was mostly interested in because Armey and Steele clashed over who to support in the year 23 special election. He's like an outside guy who hates Republicans, except that they're the only game in town now, or so he says. And I was struck, like, there weren't actually many objective or substantive arguments against the bill. There really, and reporters didn't really ask about it.
Typical.
Every time there was a question that was trying to hone in on what it is that was going to be problematic, it all went back to how Americans didn't want it and they were angry and it was and not a transparent process, which is just something neither party can ever complain about ever again in America, as far as I'm concerned, because they both do it and will always do it. But, I don't think they're actually – I'm looking ahead to this. I don't see elements of this bill that are going to be unpopular. I think the Republican argument will be Democrats ran this place for 2 years and you were losing your job, and instead of trying to rectify the situation, they passed this health care bill. And you're right, like, the only way they can avoid getting caught by Democrats who can say, well, if it was up to you, they wouldn't have even been able to afford insurance, is if Democrats, as is their want these days, run screaming away from it and into the arms of some reporter who wants to get a quote, bashing Barack Obama. I'm curious, though, about the left-right synergy that's happening against the bill. And this is something, again, Dick Armey was gloating about today. The bill is weaker in terms of, socialist one-world government takeover. The bill is weaker than he might have, the ones we were looking at a few weeks ago that had a public option and a Medicare buy-in. But, he was really happy that there's all these liberals now, most notably the feminist and pro-choice groups, but, more surprisingly, people like Jane Hampshire, people like Marcos from Daily Kos, partisan Democrats who just think this is so worthless now that it's a giveaway to insurance companies and it should be killed. I don't know. What do you think is going to happen with that? Like, if the bill passes, do you think Marcos and Jane and all these people are going to be really angry and, like, picket the White House at the signing? Or is there going to be, like, a liberal... I don't know what to make of this. It seems like they're in a state of permanent opposition, but...
It's interesting because, both sides are sort of... It's classic Barack Obama, and it's sort of classic where the Democratic leadership is right now, and that this bill, is not what conservatives would want, and it's not what liberals would want, and it's a strange sort of amalgamation of public and private. And even the public
option, Senate,
is sort of this weird hybrid. And they're both sort of going after it for being, a handout to insurance companies, but in different ways. And Ed Kilgore has a good post on this today at the New Republic. But basically, neither of the critiques really ring true. And what Marcos and Jane and other people who are sort of Netroots leaders do after the bill passes is going to be important in 2010, because if you look at 1994, it wasn't just that Republicans were so excited, it was the Democratic turnout was so low, and getting the base to come out and vote in an off year is going to be a big game changer, whether or not the Democrats lose a ton of seats or just lose some seats. And it's sort of unclear when I talk to Democratic strategists what they're going to do about getting their base out. They understand that they need to start talking about jobs, once this healthcare thing is over. But I hope that people like Marcos and Jane take a second look at this bill, because this is the bill, if you look at what Barack Obama was saying during the primaries and during the general election, that he wanted to pass. It doesn't have the public option. It doesn't have some of the things that he wanted. But on the whole, this is the plan that doesn't change your health insurance as you have it, but brings universal coverage and tries to cut costs. I mean, it's what he always said he wanted.
Well, it used to be for a mandate. I mean, he didn't...
He ran against the mandate, that's true. But at the time, he was getting crucified for not having the mandate by Hillary Clinton and other people on the left who say, rightly, in my view, that you need the mandate to make it work. And the fact that Jane Hampshire and Marcos and everybody are freaking out about the mandate now, after that debate happened in the primaries, it happened with John McCain, and after the last 6 months of, back and forth in the Senate, where in the summer, Chuck Grassley, of all people, said that there was, and I quote, a bipartisan consensus that the mandate was necessary. The fact that we never saw this opposition before, merely because the public option, which, over the last 3 months, the public option under discussion has been so sort of weakened that it wouldn't really you know, have the effect that anybody wanted it. It was more of a symbolic gesture. It would have helped provide competition. It would have been a basis, but it certainly didn't change the dynamics of the whole bill. I think speaks to not necessarily a lack of seriousness, but it seems weird to me that all of a sudden they're waking up and deciding that this bill is a big corporate handout when this bill has been what it is since the Gang of Six got together in June. They're going to have a decision to make. You know, I'll just say this last thing is that whether or not they get behind this bill as something that's a framework that can be made better, or if it's the greatest sellout of progressive policies ever, and, you know, whether one of those things is their message, will have an effect on the 2010 elections, and it would be a mistake, even if you disagree, I think, from the left with this bill to do that, because keeping Barack Obama president and keeping the Democrats in Congress is still your best chance of having even remotely progressive legislation enacted. You know, and it's one of those...
So it's really not a sellout, though? They're not onto anything? Because the I don't take a lot of that chatter very seriously. I think, you know, Jane Hampshire has some personal credibility because she's fought a lot of... had cancer and, you know, had to make critical health care decisions and has some stories about how this works right now. At the same time, I think the critique that I think is most damaging is the one from conservatives like Tim Carney, maybe only Tim Carney, who is a reporter for the Washington Examiner who wrote a book called Obamanomics, which is, it kind of finally puts together and frames this Glenn Beckian opposition to Obama, which is not supply side. I guess it kind of is when you get down to what they want to do on taxes, but it's not what the Republican Party stood for a year ago. It's that Republican Party needs to be a sort of Jeffersonian populist party that pulls the government away from involvement in things like insurance, not because that's what Stalin did, but because anytime it does so, it ends up, you know, shoveling over your money to corporations and to insurance companies. And it seems like this actually is at the root of whatever convergence there is between Dick Armey and Jane Hampshire. That's what it is. It's that Barack Obama got elected and is...
And, you know, I think that is kind of persuasive, except the sole obstacle to people to not having those policies are Republicans. If you look at what the Republican healthcare alternative was, it was getting rid of all regulation on insurance companies so they could do essentially whatever they wanted. It's a huge handout to them that involves not, you know, asking them to do anything for people.
Well, it's not really a handout, though. I mean, it's not taking making Joe college student or, well, I guess not now because you can stay on your plane at 27, but Joe grad student who's 28, wasn't going to get health care because he runs triathlons and doesn't smoke. Is now going to be paying into something, and that's going to be going to an insurance company. I mean,
well, under the
not regulating,
plan, he'd be paying higher premiums for a worse plan. You know, he'd be paying premiums for a plan based in whatever state lowered the rules enough that they could, not cover anything beyond, you know, whatever the bare limited thing is, and then pay higher premiums for it. And I think, you know, look, no one is happy on the left about, you know, providing this market for insurance companies, but if Republicans hadn't spent years saying, you know, healthcare is like a capitalist thing that you need to pay companies to do because the government should never do that, and opposing any effort to make it otherwise, Democrats would not have settled on the last decade of consensus that, fine, if we're going to reform healthcare, we have to use the private system. And I mean, look at financial regulatory reform, the Republican alternative to that. You know, when that passed the House a few weeks ago, was a motion that struck all of the regulations and repealed TARP, and that was it. So basically, they were getting rid of the handouts, which is really populist, but letting the banks do exactly what they've been doing for the past decades with no restrictions whatsoever. So I think it would be hard for anyone in the Republican leadership right now to try and claim any credibility on the sort of anti-corporate front, with their present policies. I think they need a radical change to do that.
Well, but that's just not the way they think. They don't think anti-corporate. They think anti-your money and your money helping the government intervene in the market. And you can say that that doesn't make sense because that's not the way the world actually works, and that's the root of the economic crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not something I think Democrats have convincingly pushed back against.
No.
Like, it's got real purchase with people who I think, I don't know a ton of them, but from the polling that shows President Obama less popular than he was when he got elected, it would suggest there are people who voted for him and buy into this now that, you know, they didn't like what happened with the Wall Street bailout, but they see the government's response is to just try and buttress everything that's going wrong in every market that fails. So, I mean, I think you're, you know, it's pretty, the actors who are responsible for this messaging are not acting in the shadows, you know, like Rick Berman and David Koch and all the people that Think Progress like to go after for being behind this, the Tea Party movement or what have you. You know, it's clear that they don't want regulation because they want to make more money. But, you know, like, it's a classic American argument with, you know, some deep roots that if you don't regulate and you let people make money, yeah, there'll be the occasional rapacious businessman, and yeah, there'll be the occasional person who gets left out. But, I mean, I think just look at the estate tax wars of the last couple decades to see how hard it is for liberals to dig in and make the counter-argument once the conservatives convince people that, look, you know, the government intervening in this is hurting entrepreneurship. You know, and your government getting in the way is the reason why the economy can't rebound. Take away these regulations. That's not anti-corporate. That's pro-business. That's pro-small business. That's letting America work the way it used to.
Pro-business and anti-corporate seem to go hand in hand. I mean, look, I think you're right about the Obama administration's tactics and messaging. They have done a terrible job separating themselves out from the financial sector, separating themselves out from the insurance companies and from pharma and all of the other sort of industry actors that they've had to deal with to do health reform. And that is, you know, what they see probably accurately as the price of making sure that a lot of people who didn't have health insurance yesterday will have it in the future.
I do think I was surprised there was not more of a liberal, like a Fire Dog Lake Red State Alliance on something that seemed to be winnable. Well, tough, but more winnable in place where there was more agreement because it was personalized, which was the renomination of Ben Bernanke. That's a perfect example, I think, of the Obama administration just trying to do something that would mollify the business class, which I think it did. I mean, I remember
The reason that they renominated him when they did wasn't even to mollify the business class. That was the day, the very same day. Remember, he did it on vacation in Cape Cod at 9 a.m. completely unexpectedly.
Right.
It was the day the budget review came out with the new deficit numbers, and they wanted to make sure the bond markets didn't freak out. And, you know, I don't think the bond markets would have freaked out. I think the bond market vigilantes are sort of a threat that is held over people who want to give social insurance to people. But, yeah, terrible. They got some short-term benefit from it, maybe. But, no, it was a terrible decision. And it is interesting, the conflict you see with Alan Grayson and Ron Paul, for instance, getting together. And you haven't seen that get out broader, more broadly, because I think a lot of people still don't understand what the Fed does, to be honest, despite its new prominence in our world.
I'm surprised by that. It seems like a real easy political tee-up from my perspective. I mean, here's this guy who no one really likes, who no one in the country thinks is particularly good at his job, and who, as I think Matt Iglesias is constantly pointing out, doesn't seem to be as concerned with employment rates as with bonds and as with inflation, which are things that that's part of the Fed's portfolio, but like that's not the reason the Democratic president hires a Fed chairman.
President traditionally hires a Fed chairman to keep the bond market off his back. It's what Bill Clinton did. And it's also
true.
Jimmy Carter eventually did with Paul Volcker, so funny that Paul Volcker, incidentally, is a progressive hero now, because he was the enemy of all populists in the early 80s. He had farmers protesting outside the Fed because of his inflation-fighting policies.
Well, and the things he did couldn't really be done right now, because there's not really any maneuverability with interest rates, but yeah, we're right. I mean, I think Obama has a lot of ex-Clintonites around him who remember the first 6 or 7 months of Clinton's term when Benson was at Treasury and the cabinet was pretty progressive, but Greenspan was threatening to derail basically like any of the campaign promises Clinton made that cost money.
Yep.
So, you know, having a weak Fed chairman, that's a... I see why they wanted that position, but I'm not talking about the White House perspective. I'm saying if liberals wanted to get,
one, have a campaign, two, align
with people, they could just, like, push it, fight against Bernanke, and maybe lose that fight, but that seems to be some useful populism they could engage in.
I think it is, but I agree with you completely, but here's the thing, just on the left-right issue. The real reason that you don't see more of a red state FDL or whoever sort of nexus on this issue is that, in general, liberals want the Fed to be more transparent and to actually care about unemployment and do things like quantitative easing that will affect the employment market and bring that down. Whereas on the right, the people who don't want to renominate Bernanke and the Ron Paul folks just want to get rid of the Fed entirely. And
yeah, you can occasionally make alliances with people like that. I mean, look at the tax reform coalition in the 80s. You had good government liberals who wanted more fair taxes with, you know, I think conservatives with smaller horizons than conservatives have right now. I mean, there weren't as many people who wanted to get rid of the whole system, but, you know, I think you could have found common cause with Ron Paul on this one issue.
Yeah.
I don't think he's completely right about it, but...
And I mean, the opportunity is not yet passed. It's close to being passed, but I think... I don't know, I think it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out in the next year, especially if, you know, as you say, if Marcos and Jane Hampshire and all of these people on the left, after this healthcare bill thing happens, you know, decide if they're going to make their peace with it or if and try and improve it or whatever, or if they decide to say, screw the Democrats, we don't want to help them with anything now, that's when you're going to really see if you can get sort of a populist coalition going forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's a decision
point. Well, I was trying to think of a segue.
It's a hard
and I couldn't decide on speaking of large sums of money or speaking on of coalition building. So I'm just going to give up.
An effort of decades or a decade.
Or maybe speaking of Daily Kos, I saw Avatar this weekend.
Boom.
I'll just give up. I'll just let's not pretend we have a real transition here. I think we both wanted to talk about Avatar because it's become one of those delightful movies that in a nation's time of real woe and long vacation week deadlines has a lot that people want are picking at and analyzing. We both saw it. We both saw it in. Did you see it in brilliant 3D as well?
Brilliant 3D, most definitely. Awesome glasses.
Yeah. Lots of water bubbles that were floating. I mean, I don't think I could simulate the effect here. If I wore some more red and blue tones, maybe, and some.
Well, actually, I was gonna say my shirt. I shouldn't have worn for this. It may give people at home seizures. So if you see that, it's sort of like seeing Avatar.
But So, like, everyone agrees that Avatar is really beautiful to look at.
It's a hell of a thing to see.
Yeah, I mean, it masters this technology, but it seems to be irritating all sorts of social part-time social critics of every political persuasion, really.
Name it.
I mean,
someone can find a reason not to like it. And,
yeah.
You know, it's because James Cameron relies solely on sort of classic tropes and stereotypes to tell his schlocky story, so there's something in it for everyone to be disgusted with.
Yeah, if we go back just to his last movie, I think Titanic was his last movie because he did a bunch of nature documentaries before
which,
he did this
one. Which, by
the
way, were really weird. If you ever see them, there's one he did on the Marianas Trenches where there are aliens in the end. He's a strange man. But go ahead.
Oh, that sounds like a Werner Herzog movie. he did one about Antarctica where there aren't actually aliens, but he inquires of these scientists who are investigating these deep sea monsters if he thinks that's where the idea that's where the first man got the idea for monsters. Having seen Werner Herzog do action mainstream movies, I don't want to see him do this. I mean, I think having a director with Cameron's sort of limited capacity for interesting political thought tackle this plot, I think was fine. I mean, it was like a silly plot, but I was going to say, like, you know, Titanic had some really rudimentary Marxism in the form of poor Irish people being nice and rich people in the better parts of the ship being terrible. This had basically, I'm forgetting her name, the writer for IO9, Annalie Nowitz, as she pointed out, this just had the classic white man's burden storyline, or however you want to put it, this trope that has really come up again and again and again of the white man going native and saving these in this case blue people from themselves.
It's funny. It's sort of the classic trope. You know, Dances with Wolves is always referenced. She also references Dune, and it's so strange because I think the thing that bugs me about it is one, just sort of the stereotype, you know, the colonial. I mean, the one thing that fewer people have been referencing to or comparing it to that I think should be is the American experience with the driving Native Americans off their land for their resources and things like that. But I think it's just so politically unsophisticated because really if this happened, you know, you would see some of the Na'vi, which is the blue alien species, would get co-opted by the humans, or they would trade with them. There would be exchanges. When you think about what happens in the real world when this happens, you know, people adopt guns, there's cultural clashes, there's intermingling, and none of that really happens here. And you sort of get this strange thing where, you know, the Na'vi just sort of represent nature and goodness, and the human characters don't, and everyone is condescended to in a different way. And yeah, as the author put it, it's just rewarding white privilege. It's assuaging white guilt while maintaining white privilege, I think, with the quote. And it's just sort of silly. And one of the critiques I thought that was really funny was Rayhan Salaam, darling wunderkind of the right, has written at all places Forbes, a lovely critique of the movie and a defense of entrepreneurialism and capitalism. And while, you know, I think basically he just sort of does the opposite of what Cameron does, which is also sort of unrealistic and silly. He does point out something that you don't see in the movie, and I hope I'm not spoiling it for everyone, which is you don't really see how the Na'vi live their lives in the day-to-day and what kind of benefits they want. I mean, you sort of get the sense they spend all day sort of hunting and killing and fighting jungle animals, and, you know, maybe they would like some of the guns that the people have, or other
types of things. You see it in montage form. There's lots of jumping and capturing. And things like that, and
no Na'vi ever dies except of old age or human depredation.
That's basically it. But the Rayhan critique, which I read, is that it really is that this would be boring, and that I think he calls the Na'vi sanctimonious and dull because all they really care about is surviving and living life, and he makes the argument that it's like a pro technological argument more than anything else. It's that, you know, we should take pride in mankind's drive to use minerals to create things to entertain him instead of frolicking and being one with the planet. And I guess, you know, that somebody had to make that argument, but there's a weird perennial article that comes whenever a sci-fi movie hits and, you know, people want to talk about that instead of healthcare. Why, I have no idea. Which is the conservative who would never make this argument, without prompting, just taking the side of villainy. And the classic of the genre, I think, is still Stephen Hayes or Jonathan Last, actually, in the Weekly Standard, when one of the Star Wars remakes came out. You know, it got tiresome to just keep pointing out that these George Lucas movies are really terrible, and he instead made the argument that the Empire is clearly the superior and correct and morally defensible actor in all these films. Like, the people behind the Empire, yeah, they exhibit some violence, but, you know, all they want to do is once they unite these people, they don't seem to demand much more than a democracy would. You know, they've got great control over these native populations. Everyone has their licenses and their fees. Like, people seem to be able to smuggle without a lot of trouble.
There are hidden prison camps.
Yeah, and just for fun, he papers over the fact that they destroy entire planets to keep them in line on via fear. And again, you know, this and I think that review and these the conservative take on Avatar are both coming, you know. Before Ryan did this, somebody at Andrew Breitbart's Big Hollywood wrote a piece about how this was some really stupid anti-Iraq war allegory. I don't think any of those people would make the argument that America actually is a evil force that wants to murder lots of native people and take their resources, and that and that's not the argument that George Bush made in invading Iraq. Certainly, that was the argument the left made in saying about what Bush was trying to do. They would never say, "That's right, humankind has evolved and gotten to this state so that people with lots of technology can take the oil of people with less technology." But, once some left winger makes a movie that casts that line of decision making and warfare in a negative light, then you've got these conservatives who just jump on. It's like, yeah, exactly. Like, that's exactly how it should be. You tree huggers don't get it. And it's really, the tongue is never as in cheek as you think it's going to be. It really is. By the end of the article, like, oh yeah, that's really, they really are, there's a lot of pride here about this. I guess they all want to be the Jack Nicholson character in A Few Good Men.
It's a great speech.
It's a very good speech. It's the only thing Aaron Sorkin's ever written that I think conservatives like. There are rumors of an Atlas Shrugged movie getting off the ground. Apparently, Angelina Jolie has some Randian sympathies that come out once in a while, and she's criticized Barack Obama. So eventually, there's going to be a great libertarian movie that puts all this into context. But even then, Atlas Shrugged is the kind of novel that I think if you just without it existing describe this plot to libertarians and conservatives, they'd take offense at the idea that they had no human feeling and were willing to retreat from the world and let all the poor people and vultures live in poverty and devour each other, But once you put it in a really dramatic and entertaining fashion, then they jump right on, they defense it. I know, liberals, this, all my theories about this come back to how conservatives have a lot of confidence and liberals have none. Like, really, not since the New Deal have liberals had real confidence in their ideas. Even when they're, I haven't seen many, I don't see, on the other side, I've not seen a liberal article about how Avatar is awesome because it teaches these great lessons about the environment. They're just ashamed of believing these things.
No, I don't think that's the case. I mean, honest to God, I think, in terms of the lessons that this teaches about the environment, I mean, I don't really think it has a lot to say about the environment.
Tried to use your braid as a USB port and download it into the tree?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so ridiculous and honestly so uncreative on Cameron's part. I mean, the idea that horses have six legs on other planets, it's just not very alien. But look, I mean, if you want to talk about, the movie's good message, and this is, the reason the liberal, here I am, objected to Ryan's critique, is, again, it's totally one-sided on both sides. Like, there's liberals, we love finding our little, let's have everything be good. You can have nature and technology. Why not have it all if you don't, rape the planet and also drive people off of their land and things like that. I mean, it's just, look, the message of the film, and look, I think the most telling message of the film, and I was yelled at today for saying that if you look, it was a New Yorker profile of James Cameron, who basically justified one of his decisions about the film as, look, we wanted to make the story like this so that we could have the pterodactyls fight the helicopters. I mean, I think that's the level of political sophistication we're talking about in this film, so I don't really feel the urge to read too much into it either way. But since we have to analyze it as a cultural artifact that represents the way we look at the world, I will happily defend the message of the film, which is that, outside forces should not go to different places and murder people for their resources. I'm happy to defend that. I think any liberal would. But it's just, it's a silly entertainment, and, there are 3D aliens fighting robots. I mean, there it is.
I've seen this manifest in real life, though. I remember...
the 3D aliens fighting robots.
Well, I mean, not today. It's Monday. Dad talked to me on Thursday when I go to Robot Park. But the I've seen. I think it was Earth Day. I'm just casting about my memory for what holiday it was. I think it was one of the days that liberals set aside for everyone turning off their appliances for a little while.
Do we have one of those?
And there's one critique of that, which is it takes a lot of energy to turn them back on. That's stupid. The other one was, Glenn Beck, among other conservative hosts, decided that the response to this should just be conservatives leaving their cars and lights on, just, and turning them up to maximum for as long as this period is supposed to last.
See, and this is all liberal jujitsu to get them to have higher electric bills.
Is that it? You just want to impoverish them so they can't donate to Jim DeMint's PAC?
Got me.
The plan? But, you know, that's something, I think, like, the only, I can't think of something as similarly stupid and self-destructive on the liberal side right now except for, like, the obsession with Joe Lieberman. Because clearly, like, when you poke him, he's like a hornet. He just gets angrier. And yet people keep doing it. But yeah, like, conservatives definitely, you know, they're really tired of living in this pop culture climate where all the movies are about how if you follow, you know, if you live really, really well and treat natives nice and, what else? Don't take their resources. I'm just trying to make sure I remembered all the lessons of Avatar because it's really important. Then, you know, they get tired of that, so they flip it around. And, like, I don't know if there is much more to it than just how much confidence they have in their ideas. Because it has to survive constant calumny and attacks from not just politicians, but from, you know, everyone they see on TV, from comedians. It builds up. I mean, that, I don't want to dovetail totally, but that's the entire story of Sarah Palin. She's so popular because they think, well, if liberals hate her that much, there must be something there. And with Avatar, it's, if James Cameron, that's the lesson he took from the Iraq War, then we really should double down on how awesome it is to take energy away from one, I guess, not blue people, but other colors of people. Yeah, so it's just, it makes sense. I mean, like, part of the story of America, the country you and I live in, was built on, like, on doing this lots of times and creating a really wealthy country where nice little Sioux settlements used to be. So yeah. You can either be apologized for it all the time, or you can celebrate it. And if they wanted to really go after James Cameron, like, if he becomes a problem for them, you know, he clearly is not going to give up his awesome studio where he designs 3D that looks cool and blue guys that shoot arrows in order to, like, give that back to the Apaches or something. You know, he doesn't really. He's guilty. He's not. There's not much. He feels guilty, but he's not going to do much more than that. So, you know, they're always going to win this argument. Being confident and living this opulent American lifestyle is always going to be more popular than sacrifice.
Yeah, you know, look, I just think the film and the arguments are so simplistic that I think people, I don't feel like liberals feel the need to engage with that conservative argument. It's not a lack of confidence, it's because they're so ridiculous. Because any 3-year-old who watches these movies knows in Star Wars the Rebels are good. The Rebels are awesomely good. Everyone who watches this knows the Na'vi are right. I mean, it's such broad stereotypes of evil and good that, you know, watching conservatives bend themselves into knots to justify the evil, it's not even worth talking about. It's not about confidence in your ideas. It's about, you know, basic morality plays that we use to entertain ourselves as a culture. And, you know, you can draw arguments from it or not, but it just seems like not a measure of confidence, but a measure of sort of moral failure on their part. But I don't know. I mean, I went to the movie hoping to see, you know, 3D aliens, and that's what I got. That was nice.
I think even a conservative can see 3D aliens if they open their heart when they go into this movie. Although I think to close on the most banal note possible, it does seem like the most 3D aspect of the movie are the papyrus font captions, because even when arrows were shooting across, like, the second and third row, the captions were right in front of me, and I appreciated that. You know, I've in my dotage, I like the words to be really big and in a really strange font. But I mean, I hope as the movie industry goes deeper and deeper into 3D technology as a way to say to beat Netflix streaming video. You know, I'd like other things to jump out at me. You know, next time there's a movie with aliens with poisoned arrows, that's what I want.
I will tell James Cameron the next time I see him.
Can you? I'd appreciate that. Because I think, there's going to be the liberal propaganda meeting, what? It's like, the first of the month. It's right after
you say about James Cameron is not really, you know, whatever Marxist themes you may have divulged from Titanic. One thing that's, you know, people observe about him that I don't think makes him the typical liberal caricature that people would like to paint him is that he's hugely pro-military. Like, if you look at Terminator or Aliens, like, he is in favor of the military and those sorts of things. And I read somewhere, like, some conservative was up in arms because in this movie, you know, the Navi is joined by this human marine to kill other soldiers who are private contractors, really. They're like the Blackwater of the future.
Oh, that's actually a key part of this. They, it's mercenaries versus aliens. It's not the heroic troops.
And so
it's not the space
even
marines
today,
from aliens.
You get to see part of this, you know, lovely conservative trend you're documenting is not only do, you know, conservatives bend themselves into knots to justify, you know, justify the Iraq war argument that they see being made in films, but they bend themselves in knots to justify the mercenaries in Iraq, like Blackwater, who are doing things over there, not really out of any basic conservative principle, but just because it's all sort of part of the same team. I don't know, it just seems like a fundamentally simplistic analysis. But
I think I would be fine, though, if the 6 months of healthcare discussion are replaced by 6 months of political critiques of James Cameron movies. That would be, I'd be much happier in my role as a DC journalist in a house that he can't.
I'm not sure if there would be more or less explosions in that scenario, but we can but hope.
More in 3D. Keep in mind, the 3D is key to this. Well, having, I think, solved every question America had about Avatar, I can just say it was really fun to talk to you.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Dave.
Yeah.
I guess we're signing off. It's been a pleasure. Take it easy.
You too.